Still Life. Often I stand abstracted, as if stilled before a painting, in the scullery of the old yellow house. Sunlight on the whitewashed walls, an ochre stain dribbled from the tap down the stone sink, and touch again the love I knew from my gentlewoman granny, a radiance held in the crock, the porringer, the oven glove, the churn, there as she had left them, placed and not abandoned, though she is gone and the object's gone, and the house a haunting place for spectres. I pass back into her world and see again her well-filled missal, memoriam cards, pressed, faded, forget-me-not between the pages, and sense a fragrance from freesia she has arranged in a vase upon the windowsill. Still life. Epiphanies of remembered love. All solid things redeeming us, though we stand silent, helpless, and in hope.
One of my great-great-great-grandfathers was known as the Liberator because of his prolonged, hectic, and ultimately successful campaign for what we would now describe as a basic human right, the cause of Catholic emancipation. His name was Daniel O'Connell. Everyone is familiar with his statue in Dublin, surrounded by larger-than-life-sized angels and, lower down, a crowd of men and women representing the people of Ireland, who had reason to be grateful for his vision and determination. Another great-great-great-grandfather, the Reverend John Eliot, would certainly have numbered himself among these fairly humble folk. It's often forgotten that the Emancipation Act also applied to dissenting Protestants who had been almost as cruelly legislated against as Catholics. John Eliot was a socially committed Presbyterian minister of a rural congregation in County Monaghan. He too was of a determined nature, particularly in his efforts to obtain relief for starving Catholics, Protestants and dissenters during the greatest natural disaster of the century in which these two of my forebears lived. There is a record of his addressing an appeal to the Relief Committee on behalf of victims of famine, to which he received the chilling reply that, as there was no local landlord through whom funds could be dispersed, there was nothing to be done. We can imagine his lethal frustration and disappointment. Did Eliot and O'Connell ever meet? There is anecdotal evidence to suggest that they did. An O'Connell shrine. That's how a neighbour described my Dublin grandmother's house, as I remember it, in the 1940s. Curiously, she had designed the house in the very latest Bauhaus style that accorded ill with the decorative memorabilia which it came to contain. I suppose she was making some kind of statement about the new Ireland receiving the legacy of the past. These objects had come to us through the Liberator's daughter Ellen, when Ellen married my great-great-grandfather, a union described on a broadsheet of the day as great marriage in high life. There was a smart statuette of O'Connell dressed as a Roman senator. A reproduction of the painting by Haverty showed Dan posed beside a round tower in the company of two impressive wolfhounds. The most forceful piece in the collection was a vast portrait of Ellen in old age. This formidable lady clearly had something on her mind as she gazed out through the murk of years into the future of my granny's angular home. She appeared to be holding something in her left hand. When my father inherited the painting and cleaned its surface with soft soap and water, the object of her reverie disclosed itself, a miniature of her dad, the Liberator, in a harp-shaped frame studded, appropriately enough, with emeralds. The extraordinary thing was that we still had this miniature, displayed among a tousle of small ornaments in a rickety glass cabinet. It had been presented to Dan by a ladies' committee when he was Lord Mayor of Dublin. Frayed cardboard boxes contained letters in O'Connell's hand. One of these still causes me a catch in the breath. Dated London, the 13th of April, 1829, it was addressed to his wife, Mary, in Merrion Square. My own darling love, the day has at length arrived when the royal assent is to be given to the Catholic Bill, that emancipation for which I have so long struggled is at length achieved. I am going to the House of Lords to be present at the giving of the royal assent. I recall my Ulster granny relating a story that had been told to her by her granny. After Daniel O'Connell had addressed one of his monster repeal meetings, he was introduced to some of his admirers, one of whom was the Reverend Elliot, present that day with his little daughter and her school friend. This granny told me that the great man placed his hand on little Miss Elliot's head, not on her friend's head, but on her head, as she was wont to repeat proudly when an old woman. What none of those present were to know, of course, was that 100 years later the two families, unaware of this chance meeting, would be united by the marriage of the couple who would become my parents.
Three plump pigeons pick at bits of waste food on Blackamoor Lane in Cork on a Sunday afternoon. Nearby, the ironically named pub Sober Lane is open for business, with a smattering of 20-somethings drinking beer while Sky Sports, on three bright screens, begs for attention. I spot a large sketch of an old-fashioned gentleman on one of the walls and wonder if it could possibly be that of the famous reformer who made his mark in this area of the city, founding a school in the vicinity and kicking off his abstinence from alcohol campaign in the 19th century. But on closer inspection, I see that the drawing is that of Arthur Guinness and not of Father Theobald Matthew. Sober Lane itself, a few yards away from the pub, was named in honour of Father Matthew. His first Cork meeting took place on April 10th, 1838, in a Capuchin schoolroom in nearby Blackamoor Lane. By the end of the following year, the reputation of the Cork Temperance Society began to spread. By 1840, it is recorded that up to 200,000 people nationwide had sworn off drink. Cork pledged its undying allegiance to the memory of Father Matthew when, in the year 2000, a proposal to move the statue of him on Patrick Street to Winthrop Street was abandoned following protests. There has been no such outcry in Dublin, where Father Matthew's statue is going to be moved from O'Connell Street next year for the Lewis. A new home is being sought for it. You would think that the statue of Father Matthew on Cork's main thoroughfare is the only statue in the city. That's because it is referred to quite simply as the statue and has been a meeting place for generations of Cork people going on a jag, local slang for a date. "I'll see you at the statue" is all you need to say to a fellow Cork denizen. And the Kilkenny-born Father Matthew is referred to in song, namely "The Boys of Fir Hill". It includes the killer lines, "The smell from Patrick's bridge is wicked. How does Father Matthew stick it?" But why do Corkonians, who need no excuse to have a drink, hold Father Matthew in such regard? Father Matthew stuck it out in Cork when others would have bolted. Apart from his role in the temperance movement, he was known and loved in Cork for his efforts to alleviate distress during the cholera epidemic of 1832, and during the famine from 1845 to 1850. He also established St. Joseph's Cemetery for the poor of the city. He was something of a saviour, capable of bringing people together in the face of adversity. This man, regarded by some as a visionary socialist, was sympathetic towards what we now know as alcoholism. His patience with drunkards was probably informed by his belief that many excessive drinkers were driven to the demon drink by their impoverished circumstances. It has been claimed that Father Matthew was himself a heavy drinker before he saw a vision of a strange birdman who told him to change his ways. Whatever the source of his desire to help people, Father Matthew practiced what he preached and obviously struck a chord in Cork before reaching out to the rest of the country and abroad. What kind of a man was he? Father Matthew's biographer and founder of the Cork Examiner, John Francis McGuire, described his subject as not a man of shining abilities, nor was he a profound or severely trained scholar. Neither had he fashioned his style upon the best models or improved his taste by a thorough acquaintance with those authors whose works are the classics of English literature. Thackeray met Father Matthew in Cork in 1842. He wrote, "There is nothing remarkable in Mr. Matthew's manner, except that it is exceedingly simple, hearty and manly. And he does not wear the downcast, demure look, which, I know not why, certainly characterises the chief part of the gentlemen of his profession." The writer added that Father Matthew is almost the only man that I have met in Ireland who, in speaking of public matters, did not talk as a partisan. Clearly, Father Matthew had something that gave him guru-like status. At one stage, the pledged abstainers in Ireland were reckoned to be in the millions. Today, Father Matthew is still a vital part of Cork lore, but he would no doubt be aghast that a pub is named after his old stomping ground, Sober Lane.
Moving house. I have packed these things in the sealed boxes. There's the clothes, the warm, the comfortable, the fabulous. Fits well, will fit someday. Never fit, should never have given away. A soft hug, our wedding day, my prom. Throw out the hand-me-downs. Over here are all the kitchen wares. Saucepans with wooden spoons that my toddlers played as drums. And all the splash water from their helping with the washing up. Bring the smell of baked bread, the melt of chocolate into crispies. Leave any burnt bacon or failed cakes. When you lift the TVs and the radios, carry them carefully. They contain the Luxembourg DJ saying Elvis had just died, or David Essex seeing the lamplight shining through my window. They still hold our sons watching Fraggle Rock lose all the soaps. If we leave behind several years, would it give us more time to spare? Take a strong shower, our cosy bed. I'll carry our first dance, sunshine on my skin, family dinners, and every Springsteen concert. Don't bring the day Ian broke his leg, sleepless nights, or any of our fights. I'd like to bring De Valera and Collins so both grannies would be happy. Martin Luther's dream and Mandela's release. Take the leap of dolphins at Lahinch, sunset off Arran Moor, and any part of Paris. Pack it all away, and when the house is empty, I'll go happily, as long as you're beside me.
In March 1965, I bought 2 sixpenny periodicals, which I have to this day. But apart from surviving so long together, in different boxes, in many attics, at various addresses, they have little else in common. Our Boys, a story paper published by the Christian Brothers, was at one time the largest selling periodical in Ireland. The March issue of 50 years ago is a typical mix of adventure, fun and information, as the slogan has it on the cover. Although the green-inked illustration of St. Patrick underneath reminds the reader he must also be mindful of his Irish heritage. Our Boys was launched in 1914 as an alternative to the Boys' Own paper, the first in a range of similar publications celebrating the kind of British stiff upper lip masculinity often lampooned today. But although Our Boys had an Irish nationalist ethos, it retained many elements of its British counterparts, including a boarding school serial, Murphy of the Fourth Form. Murphy even has an Indian classmate nicknamed the Raja. Another of the regular features in this issue is a yarn from the travelling storyteller Kitty the Hare, whose tales of haunted houses and wailing banshees were told in Shanachie style. Most editions featured a couple of one-off adventure stories as well. In this one, there's a pirate escapade set in the South Seas and a detective whodunit entitled The Mystery of Murchison's Manor. There's also a pull-out section in Irish that includes a comic strip character called Lauros Leprechaun. Shorter pieces on sport, science, mythology and natural history add variety. And finally, there's a jokes page. Readers were paid half a crown if theirs was published, as was this one. "We have everything on the menu today, sir," said the waiter. "So I see," said the customer. "How about bringing me a clean one?" In first year, I used to read Our Boys from cover to cover. But by that intercert year of 1965, its appeal had waned, perhaps because it wasn't keeping in touch with the kind of interests I had developed. Foremost among these was the music being made by English beat groups and American folk singers. So it's perhaps not surprising that the second periodical I've kept since March 1965 is an edition of the weekly New Musical Express, NME for short. The yellowing newsprint is thumbed and torn, evidence of having been read many times over. Even now, it's 12 pages of snappily presented music news, gossip, interviews, chart placings, photos and ads are packed with information that's still of interest. Some of the writing is tweet-like in its terseness. For example, "An appeal to fans from Mick Jagger. Please return his sealskin coat." And how about this? "Forecast. In the charts, Bob Dylan will overtake Donovan." That bite-sized pronouncement refers to Donovan's first single, Catch the Wind, being overtaken by The Times They Are A-Changin', which had been released to coincide with the announcement of Dylan's first concert tour in the UK. An advertisement for the concerts takes up almost half the NME's front page, and inside we're told that the Beatles, quote, "are expected to join the audience for the folk singer's show in the Albert Hall." Although he would be touring with just his guitar and harmonica, there were growing rumours that on his next LP, Bob Dylan was going electric. As a fan, I wasn't sure what to think of this, but it was the kind of tantalising tidbit one could glean from the pages of the NME. In a broader sense, the paper reflected a world that was changing in all sorts of exciting ways as far as teenagers were concerned, and the change was being spearheaded by music and musicians. By the end of the year, following the release of Dylan's Bringing It All Back Home and the Beatles' Rubber Soul albums, there would even be talk of pop music turning into an art form. And bit by bit, the NME had to adopt a less frivolous style of journalism to keep pace with the continuing evolution of popular culture. But if the times were a-changing in 1965, Our Boys seemed oblivious to it. The paper continued on, much as it was until the 1980s, when it tried to modernise, but by then it was too late, and eventually it ceased publication. As for Bob Dylan, he's still with us, still making music, and still ringing the changes.
Ile de la Cité, Place Geneviève to Centre Pompidou. We follow the hill down towards the quays, across Rue des Écoles, onto Les Îles, beyond the boundary of Notre Dame, find ourselves strolling over a bridge, Pont de l'Archeveche, rails a tapestry of locks, notice each other out of step in the chill, gossipy wind. The downpour has ceased. You continue straight across, past tacky declarations decked with ribbons and scrawled hearts. I delay to take a photo, gaze at found art. 2,000 locks gleam in the sun. They nod to Abelard and Eloise. Keys rust on the riverbed of the Seine. Where now the couples that broadcast vows in stealth? Latched to this island in the current, what to each will the future bring? What happens to a lover's heart or to the plagues of chastity belts? We walk away to Quai aux Fleurs. Day and night, the locks transmit a wanton pledge.
In the course of research I was doing for a book on John McGahern, I had the privilege of conducting a number of interviews with the Leitrim writer. On each occasion, he was courteous and accommodating, while at the same time constantly wary of saying something that might be misconstrued. What I enjoyed particularly were the chats before and after the formal interviews. It was then that John's wit and humanity shone through. He regularly asked me about my Tipperary roots, my family, and my work. He would regale me with stories about characters he knew in Leitrim and of amusing encounters he had had with certain Irish literary figures. As my mother would say, he was a real tonic. Unsurprisingly, therefore, when news reached me of his death on the 30th of March 2006, I was shocked and dismayed. On the last occasion we had met, in his home in Stonybatter, he was coming from hospital where he had been receiving treatment for cancer. "I am one of their positive statistics," he said to me, and I believed him, because not to do so would mean countenancing the thought of a time when his unique presence would no longer be there to reassure us with his comforting words. Looking back on it now, it seems wholly appropriate that John died when spring was already coming to grips with the last vestiges of winter and nature was again unveiling all its glory. The funeral in the lovely little church of Ochawillan. His laying to rest alongside his beloved mother in the adjoining cemetery. The decade of the rosary at the graveside. Everything was in conformity with local custom, just as the writer would have wanted it. While we still feel his loss keenly, we will always have those beautifully crafted words, with their wonderful evocation of lanes, ditches, birds, trees, skies, all of which combine to generate an exquisite literary topography of Leitrim and Roscommon. And then we have characters like Mourne, the patriarch of amongst women, who realises on the threshold of death the amazing glory he was part of. The luxuriant carpet of grass in the meadow at the back of his house reminds Mourne of his mortality, which prompts the poignant observation to his wife Rose and daughters, "I never knew how hard it is to die." Similarly, Elizabeth Regan, the main protagonist in McGahern's first novel, The Barracks, on discovering she has terminal cancer, begins to fully appreciate the beauty all around her. "Jesus Christ," is all she can summon up to express her awe as she looks out the barracks window and notes. The light had slanted, making such violence on the water that she'd to shade her eyes to see the reeds along the shore, the red navigation barrels caught in a swaying blaze at the mouth of the lake, and the soft rectangles of shadow behind. Fortunately, John McGahern did not have to wait for his cancer diagnosis to savour the landscape that moulded his artistic inspiration. The first page of memoir describes the soil of Leitrim, the fields and vegetation which have remained almost completely unchanged for decades. Walking along the lanes where he lived transported him back to the time he accompanied his mother to school. We read, "In certain rare moments over the years, while walking on these lanes, I have come into an extraordinary sense of security, a deep peace, in which I feel I can live forever." McGahern associated the area around Achawillan with his dead mother, and hence the feeling of peace and security that he experienced on certain rare moments when retracing their steps of several years earlier. It is fitting that memoir ends with another evocation of the beloved mother whom McGahern lost at the tender age of 10. "I would want no shadow to fall on her joy and deep trust in God. She would face no false reproaches. As we retraced our steps, I would pick for her the wild orchid and the windflower." Spring and McGahern will always be synonymous in my mind. At this time of year, I like to imagine mother and son soaring above the Leitrim landscape, taking stock of all the wonders of nature and reveling in the mysteries of the universe.